Thank you very much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. I hope we will get the seminar and the center off to a good start today. During the course of the coming year, as I understand it, the Sawyer Seminar on the Dynamics of Inequality is going to be trying to make sense of the baffling diversity in the current history of inequality, as David has said. Just a couple of the obvious changes that are going on that seem to go in quite different directions. Since the 1970s, inequality between men and women in the United States has declined really drastically, dramatically. It's one of the major social changes that I've lived through in my lifetime. But over the same years, the United States has experienced a historic increase in inequality of incomes. And this tendency is manifest in many other countries as well. That is, not just in the United States, but in many other countries that one sees an increase in inequality of incomes. There are a few countries that have had slight declines in inequality of income, and a number that have had very sizable increases. So the general trend is in the present world is toward increasing inequality of income. So the trends run in opposing, seemingly contradictory directions. Now, I can't be of much help to the Center or the Sawyer Seminar in explaining the precise dynamics of such recent changes in patterns of inequality. Not only do I lack the appropriate technical know-how, and it does take some technical know-how, obviously, to sort these things out, but I'm a specialist in history of 18th and 19th century France, not the contemporary world. What I hope I can provide is a certain theoretical perspective on the dynamics of equality and inequality, together with a longer-term historical perspective. I'll argue in this lecture that understanding the dynamics of capitalism is absolutely key for thinking about both equality and inequality in modern history. I believe that capitalism, over its long historical span of more than three centuries, has created pressures conducive both to uniformity and equivalence, and hence a certain form of equality, and at the same time to unequal accumulation, and hence to inequality of means. These seemingly contradictory tendencies are, I will argue, generated simultaneously and continuously out of the core processes of capitalism. They are, in other words, intrinsic to its dynamic. Hence, it shouldn't be surprising to see contradictory trends and patterns of inequality in the present, or for that matter, at any time in the history of capitalism. If we're to take capitalism seriously, I think we need to begin with Karl Marx and the Marxist tradition, which has been thinking deeply about capitalism for a very long time. Indeed, it's arguable that only the Marxist tradition has actually taken capitalism seriously as an object of analysis. For example, it seems to me that that most academic economic history doesn't really recognize capitalism as a distinct entity. It assumes that economic man has been around since the Stone Age, and that the extraordinary changes of the past few years are, in that sense, fundamentally continuous with what came before. Marx, by contrast, saw economic man as a specific historical product of the capitalist era. He attempted to identify what he regarded as a fundamentally novel set of economic, social, and cultural relations that came into existence in Europe in the early modern period and that have a systemic, dynamic, and self-perpetuating character that was lacking in all previous modes of social organization. We should perhaps note that capitalism as Marx saw it, is founded on a constitutive contradiction, that it combines extraordinary forward-thrusting dynamism and restlessness with self-perpetuation, which implies a constancy of capitalism's core forms in spite of the incessant changes that capitalism also gives rise to. So that seems to me one of the interesting contradictory moments of capitalist dynamics. Although Marx is often taken as an economic determinist, I see him as providing the basis for a concept of capitalism as a kind of cultural system, with its specific values, ethos, obsessions, and emotional tonalities. Marx also saw capitalism as a peculiarly contradictory and perverse social system, one that created unprecedented levels of material wealth yet spread misery, one that liberated humans from immemorial forms of social oppression, but also subjected them to new, equally painful, and equally destructive social oppressions. This dialectical and ambivalent stance toward the world seems to me quite appropriate for the subject at hand, the simultaneous advance of equality and inequality in the contemporary world. The driving force of capitalism, in Marx's account, is itself profoundly perverse, profoundly so. That is, accumulation for accumulation's sake. Unlike previous dominant classes, capitalists seek wealth not for the power it enables or for the enjoyment of worldly delights that it might afford, but rather for accumulation of wealth itself. This drive for accumulation becomes a feature of the personality of the capitalist, of course, but it's also inseparable from the nature of capitalism as an institutional order. Marx remarks that the capitalist is to be regarded not as an individual, but rather as what he calls the bearer of the social relations of capital. The endless accumulation of capital is built upon the universal exchange of commodities. Items possessing use value, things that are useful in other words, become, in capitalism, the bearer of an abstract quantity, exchange value, which is denominated in money. Marx, in his wonderful riff on the fetishism of the commodity in Volume 1 of Capital, tries to convey to us the strangeness of life under the sign of capital. The physical or psychic utility of things, their use value, becomes under capitalism totally subordinated to their exchange value, their money value, which makes them tradable for other commodities. The capitalist's game is to buy and sell commodities in such a way as to continually increase the exchange value at his or her command. The value the capitalist accumulates is used as a means of exchange through continuing investment to produce ever more commodities with ever greater value, and so on indefinitely. Now, in Marx's scheme, the surplus value, as he calls it, that makes the endless accumulation characteristic of capitalism possible results from a specific form of commodity exchange, the exchange of the commodity labor power for a wage. Once this secret, as he calls it, of the accumulation of capital had been discovered, depending on your favorite account, sometime between the 16th and the 18th century, the key to accumulation everywhere in a capitalist economy has been, according to Marx, the production of surplus value through the exploitation of legally free but economically subordinated labor. This extraction of surplus value can be accomplished, again, I'm following Marx here, by two means, what he calls the production of absolute and of relative surplus value. Absolute surplus value is produced by what one might call exploitation, pure and simple. By increasing the hours or the intensity of labor or decreasing wages without fundamentally changing the way goods are produced. Relative surplus value, which is the form of surplus value that, according to Marx, is specific to capitalism, is produced subtly, indirectly, by increasing the productivity of labor. This is done by means of superior technology or organization, but the productivity is increased without proportionately increasing wages. It is this mechanism of creating relative surplus value through innovation that imparts to capitalism its unique dynamic, according to Marx. By adopting a technique of production superior to the existing technique in his particular specialty, the capitalist can reap what we might call super profits. He must increase his capital outlay in order to increase his productivity, but when he does so, his cost of production per unit falls below that of competitors. He therefore can cut his prices below the prevailing level and at the same, and thereby greatly increasing his share of the market, and at the same time gain a handsome margin of profit on every sale. But these super profits are not destined to last. Some of the firms in the industry will be driven out of business by the consequences of the innovation, but those that survive will, of course, adopt the new technology as quickly as possible, and the initial innovators' profits will soon decline to the mediocre level that had obtained before the innovation. However, by this time, all firms' capital outlays will have increased, and the productivity of the industry will be at a higher level. Once begun, this process of cost-cutting productivity increases will be repeated over and over, steadily increasing the capitalization of firms and driving the weakest competitors out of business. The ever-increasing concentration of capital is therefore built into the system. The capitalist, in order to remain a capitalist, must accumulate capital endlessly. This dynamic, once begun in a single industry or a single region, will expand outward to other regions and other industries. Demand in the initial industry may eventually be more or less saturated, but the techniques developed there can normally be adapted with a little ingenuity to new industries. Thus, the mechanical techniques that were invented in the English cotton industry in the late 18th century spread to other countries and were adopted to the woolen, linen, and silk industries rather quickly. Eventually, mechanical techniques modeled essentially on those of the textile industry were used to produce many other kinds of consumer goods as well, from shoes and clothing to toys, paper, bread, breakfast cereal, automobiles. And the model of seeking temporary super profits and increased market share by investing in productivity-enhancing techniques has become the defining strategy of capitalism, or at least one of the defining strategies of capitalism generally. But while this process of relative surplus value production is the primary source of capitalism's peculiar dynamism, it's also true that capitalists, as capitalists, don't care how the accumulation of capital happens so long as it happens. The seemingly more primitive techniques of production of absolute surplus value will also be pursued whenever they're available. Thus, for example, capitalists will continue to make use of the presence of what Marx called the reserve army of labor, unemployed or underemployed workers, to force down wages or force up hours or intensity of labor whenever they can do it. Now, this brief exposition of what I see as at least a portion of the basic Marxian schema is obviously highly compressed and is oversimplified. But it's enough to evoke, I think, capitalist society's contradictory pressures toward both equality and inequality. The foundation of the pressure toward equality lies in what Marx called the commodity form. The predominance of the commodity in capitalism produces a particular type of social relations, according to Marx, in which all kinds of difference are abstracted away, made unimportant in the face of the one crucial variable, that is, exchange value. The progressive generalization of the commodity form imparts a drive toward uniformity or formal equality in capitalist societies. Okay, so there's actually, through the production of this uniformity, there's a certain kind of logic of equality that's built into capitalist societies by comparison with pre-capitalist societies. The tracing out of this kind of implication has been a part of a subordinate strain in the Marxist tradition. Its chief spokesmen, I suppose, have been Georg Lukács and certain members of the Frankfurt School. In recent years, this line of argument has been further adumbrated by my University of Chicago colleague, Moish Postone, in his difficult but brilliant book, Time, Labor, and Social Domination. I'll take up the argument about capitalism and equality in the final portion of this talk. The predominant strain in the Marxist tradition has focused much more heavily on accounting for inequality. This account, as I understand it, is based above all on two central claims. First, that wage labor is fundamentally exploitative, and second, that the capitalist competition of each against all results in ever-increasing concentration of capital. It's the unending concentration of capital that, in my reading, provides the essential underlying pressure in capitalist societies toward inequality of incomes. Anyone who has read the Communist Manifesto will be aware that Marx himself predicted an increasing polarization of the class structure between an ever-growing proletariat and an ever-richer but ever-shrinking bourgeoisie. He claimed that intermediate classes such as the petite bourgeoisie and the peasantry would steadily disappear, that the wealth of the bourgeoisie would be concentrated into ever fewer hands, with unsuccessful competitors being cast downward into the proletariat, and that the proletariat would become ever larger and ever more uniformly immiserated. Nor was this prediction merely a youthful enthusiasm of Marx in the revolutionary era of the 1840s. Very similar claims appear, for example, in Capital, which was written two decades later. What one might call Marx's permanent moral thrust was a condemnation of the exploitation of the proletariat by the bourgeoisie. And his permanent political thrust was to advocate and also to prognosticate a proletarian revolution that would, as he put it, expropriate the expropriators and usher in an egalitarian communist society. Now, Marx's historical prognostications have pretty obviously had a highly mixed record. The proletarian revolution, which seemed to many to have arrived in Russia in 1917, failed to spread to the more advanced industrial societies where Marx had predicted it would first take place. Nor, to put it mildly, did the regime put into place by the Bolsheviks lead to an egalitarian utopia. On the other hand, Marx was certainly right about many of the long-term trends of capitalist development. The property-owning petite bourgeoisie still exists. We all, you know, see that it does, but it is declining steadily in the face of competition from bigger businesses, industrial corporations, giant construction firms, chain stores, and the like. The peasantry, or for that matter, family farms of any sort, have virtually disappeared in the most highly developed countries, even in the United States, where agriculture remains an extremely important economic activity. And the concentration of capital has marched forward relentlessly, both in advanced countries and on a world scale. These historical trends have not, however, led to the class bifurcation that Marx foresaw for various reasons. For one, the professions and the salaried managerial class have both grown steadily since Marx's time, and he didn't really foresee this, forming new intermediate classes that partially replaced the declining peasantry and the petite bourgeoisie. Nor have capitalist societies evolved uniformly in the direction of increased inequality of incomes. Contemporary advanced capitalist countries vary enormously in their levels of inequality. If you take the richest, the most advanced capitalist societies, the most unequal is the United States, the most equal, Denmark and Sweden. There have also been major fluctuations, both rises and falls, in the extent of income inequality over time in any given capitalist society. So there certainly has not been any, you know, sort of uniform trend or linear trend that we can identify over time. Now, generally speaking, income distribution became increasingly unequal during the process of industrialization in the 19th and early 20th centuries, as concentration of capital enriched successful industrialists and de-skilling depressed the wages of labor. For instance, it's the case that in Britain, the average height which turns out to be a very good measure of the average health of the population and level of living, actually declined in the course of the 19th century until the late 19th century with industrialization. That's a sign that that things were actually getting worse for most people. Initially, there tends to be an increase in the inequality. But in the middle of the 20th century, and most dramatically in the years following World War II, income distribution in the advanced capitalist societies tended to become considerably more equal. Initially, this inverted U-shaped pattern, that is, first increasing inequality and then decreasing inequality, this pattern of change was interpreted as a kind of law-like long-term effect of industrialization. The great economist Simon Kuznets posited that as agrarian societies industrialized and urbanized, the range of incomes would necessarily expand and inequality would consequently rise, but that once the great transfer of population from rural to urban occupations ran its course and universal education in urban areas led to ever more equal levels of human capital, as was universal education, levels of inequality would fall once again to a more moderate level. This putatively universal pattern of the rise and subsequent fall of income inequality as a consequence of industrialization was dubbed the Kuznets curve. But by the time Kuznets died in 1985, inequality was actually quite sharply on the rise once again in many of the advanced industrial countries. The Kuznets curve, in other words, had turned into what Harrison and Bluestone in a book published in 1988 called the Great U-Turn. So you have first an increase, then a decrease, and then an increase, which could not be, the increase at the end could not be predicted from the Kuznets curve kind of logic. The rise of income inequality in the past 30 years has, of course, shattered the notion that advancing industrial and economic development leads naturally or necessarily to greater income inequality. This trend has greatly revived, I think, the plausibility, at least, of Marxist accounts of political economic development. The fundamental claim of most Marxist work on recent economic history is that the declining inequality of the 1930s through the 1960s, which is, you know, very definite and measurable, must be attributed fundamentally to political causes that counteracted the inherent tendency of capitalist societies toward extreme income inequality. I think that's the general Marxist argument. There are, of course, many different accounts of the social and socioeconomic and political history of the 20th century put together by Marxists. I'll try to convey what I take to be the essentials of the argument. The Great Depression of the 1930s was certainly the deepest crisis ever in the history of capitalism. Indeed, it was not evident that capitalism would survive, given the challenges of both Soviet communism and the various fascist movements in fascist countries. In the aftermath of World War II, in the context of a growing rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union, the political elites of the United States, Western Europe, and Japan had every reason to promote policies that would ward off a renewed depression, and also that would conciliate capital and labor. All the more so because there were sizable communist parties in certain key European countries, most importantly Italy and France, that might threaten the stability of capitalist democracies. Hence, these Cold War allies all adopted one form or another of interventionist welfare states. They had extensive state involvement in the economy, strong and legally protected labor movements, and growing welfare states that strove for social protection, full employment, and high wages. This regime of what were called mixed economies, because they mixed free enterprise and government involvement, was underwritten by overwhelming United States military and economic dominance of the free world, as it was called, during the era of the Cold War. These welfare states, it may be argued, managed to keep capitalism's fundamentally exploitative and inegalitarian tendencies under control. This outcome was aided by the record levels of economic growth that were attained in the post-war era, which made it possible for profits and wages to rise simultaneously. It appeared in this age of Simon Kuznets that the socially divisive and crisis-ridden period of capitalism had been left behind forever. But this golden age of welfare capitalism, of course, didn't last. In the late 1960s and the early 1970s, the post-war political economic era of good feeling fell apart. Youth revolts challenged the status quo in all the advanced democracies. Labor militancy rose at the very time that corporate profits were beginning to fall substantially as European and Japanese industries competed with increasing success against the previously supreme industries of the United States. The United States, which was running a massive budget deficit in part to finance a losing war effort in Vietnam, ceased to be able to underwrite the fixed rate currency exchange regime that had been agreed to at the post-war Bretton Woods conference. And by 1973, all currencies were floating on the open market. Actually, the dollar was mostly sinking on the open market at that time. In 1973, the oil embargo following the Arab-Israeli Yom Kippur War pushed up energy prices sharply, and the advanced capitalist economies entered a period of so-called stagflation, a puzzling combination that hadn't really been seen heretofore, of stagnation and inflation that existing Keynesian methods of economic management seemed unable to control. The result of these multiple difficulties was a decade of recurrent economic crisis and deindustrialization in great swaths of Europe and the United States. This was the period when the notion of the Rust Belt was coined. The rate of economic growth in the world economy, which had been about 3% per annum in the 1950s and the 1960s, fell sharply to something much closer to 1% in the 1970s, and it's been there most of the time since. This multiform economic crisis, excuse me, this multiform economic crisis of the 1970s ended the post-war golden age. By the late 1970s or the early 1980s, the Keynesian welfare states forged in the post-war were, to greater or lesser degrees, under attack in the various advanced capitalist countries. At one extreme were the United States and the United Kingdom, where under Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, there were fierce and quite effective attacks on labor unions and the welfare state, together with a tilting of economic policy toward globally oriented financial services. In these countries, income distributions became increasingly unequal, began to become increasingly unequal around 1980, and have become steadily more unequal ever since. Elsewhere in the advanced industrial economies, the pattern has varied. One of the interesting things is how much variation there's actually been. In France and Germany, for example, the welfare state has remained essentially intact. Labor has retained a greater degree of power by far than in the US or even in Britain, where initially labor had been extremely powerful. And income inequality has not worsened. In fact, it's actually gotten slightly decreased. It should be pointed out, however, that this retention of certain important features of the post-war compromise has been paid for by an abandonment of full employment policies. Unemployment has hovered at nearly 10% in both Germany and France pretty much ever since the 1980s. The pattern of variation in trends in income inequality seems to me consistent with the Marxist hypothesis that the mid-20th century decline in income inequality was a consequence of political rather than economic causes. Where labor unions and social democratic parties have retained a reasonable degree of power, inequality has advanced little, if any. Where labor has been crushed, inequality has skyrocketed. A brief look at the US in this comparative perspective seems particularly instructive, since it has experienced the most sustained rightward political turn of any of the advanced industrial economies, and is also has the highest level of income inequality among such countries. Since the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, unions, labor unions have been attacked. In fact, they've been virtually eliminated as an economic and political actor. At this point, or in 2006, fewer than 8% of the private sector workers in the United States were members of labor unions. Income and capital gains rates, tax rates paid by the wealthy have been cut drastically. Welfare programs have been slashed. Numerous spheres of business activity have been deregulated, International trade has been substantially freed. Monetary policy has systematically favored low levels of inflation over full employment. In short, the entire complex regime of class compromises worked out in the New Deal and the post-war has been pretty much wrecked and replaced by a new neoliberal regime, as it's sometimes called, that systematically favors capital over labor. With the former mechanisms of redistribution gone and the constraints on exploitation of labor rolled back, the underlying unequal dynamics of capitalism have reasserted themselves in the United States with great vigor, creating the so-called New Gilded Age of the early 21st century. Now, I don't want to claim that rising inequality in recent decades is entirely a function of the end of a politics of class compromise. There certainly are other changes in economic context that are conducive to increasing inequality. For example, there's been a shift toward higher information intensity in economic activity in the United States and elsewhere, a shift that many economists have argued tends to increase the relative rewards of the educated and the talented. There's been a worldwide surge of low-skill immigration toward wealthy countries. There's also been the advent of new information technologies that make it possible to export much routine manufacturing and production work to low-wage economies, effectively, in Marxist terminology, pushing down wages in economic metropoles by globalizing the reserve army of labor. In other words, it's by harnessing the underemployed or unemployed workers outside of the richest countries that there's been downward pressure placed on the labor force on wages in the richer countries. Okay, I lost my place. Yes, okay, but most of these potentially inequality-enhancing tendencies are actually global in character. They should, in principle, affect Denmark as much as they do the United States. It's above all in the United States, and to a lesser extent in the United Kingdom, that capitalists have been allowed by lack of regulation or encouraged by various government policies to take advantages of these tendencies in order to drive down the price of labor and increase the rewards of capital. In other words, where the class politics of the past 40 years have not resulted in such an unequivocal victory for capital, the global inequality-generating forces that may be encouraging rising inequality have been blocked, or more commonly, somewhat mitigated. But the socioeconomic and political history of the past 40 years seems to indicate that in the absence of strong countervailing political tendencies, the grand Marxist dynamic of endless accumulation, exploitation of labor, and concentration of capital continues to operate in the contemporary world. Now, it's hardly surprising. It's hardly surprising to hear an argument that capitalism has a built-in tendency toward inequality. This is not only a commonplace among Marxists, but it's also found its way into folk wisdom. But what about the less conventional claim that capitalism also exerts pressures for equality? I've intimated above that it's the structuring effect of the commodity form on social life in capitalist societies that promotes a certain type of equality. So let me begin by quickly sketching out the logic of the commodity form. When two commodities meet in the marketplace, and Marx in chapter one of Capital loves to do these kind of parodic little exercises where commodity A meets commodity B and they shake hands in the marketplace. When they meet in the marketplace, what matters about them is not their specific sensory characteristics or their possible uses. Rather, what matters is what they're worth in money terms. That is, their exchange value is what matters. A heap of coal, a bolt of cloth, a bushel of apples, and a pair of scissors are each distinct commodities with particular physical characteristics and uses. Yet what matters about them in the capitalist marketplace is that they're each exchangeable for, let's say, $20. utterly different in kind, they are nevertheless equivalent as commodities, that is, as exchange values. Now, as capitalism expands spatially from industry to industry by the kinds of mechanisms that I described earlier, the logic of the commodity infiltrates more and more into the logic of social life in general. This is particularly true because labor, that is, a crucial form of purposeful human sensuous activity, itself becomes a commodity under capitalism. Two human beings, with their differences in physiognomy, character, social origins, gender, sexual proclivities, height, weight, or musical taste, meet in the labor market as sheer exchange values. That is, as bundles of attributes with a given capacity to produce surplus value for the capitalist. Because work, a crucial feature of human daily experience, is fundamentally structured by the commodity form under capitalism, the worker, an intelligent and sensitive being, after all, comes increasingly to regard himself or herself from the perspective of exchange value, from the perspective of the commodity. The experience of commodity labor causes the worker, that is, all of us, to internalize the perspective of exchange value. From this perspective, one is what one earns, or what one is capable of earning. Likewise, from the perspective of the capitalist who is hiring labor, what's important is how well the worker can perform the job, not the worker's musical taste, or weight, or gender, or race. You can probably see where I'm going here. The capitalist who, by convention, must choose his or her workers from some restricted social category, from white men or from Slovak immigrants, has a standing incentive to hire from beyond the category in order to expand the pool of available skills and thereby improve the quality of the labor hired, or to undermine the effective monopoly of a given social category and drive down wages by increasing competition for jobs. Of course, capitalists don't always act according to this pure commodity rationality for a number of reasons that are very real but contingent to this basic commodity logic. For example, the cost of the existing labor force's resistance, say, to hiring black or Hispanic workers in a previously lily-white firm may outweigh the benefits to the capitalist of potentially lower wages or potential long-term labor docility, and therefore the capitalist will not hire blacks and Hispanics. Or the cost of recruiting labor broadly may actually be greater for the capitalist than that of recruiting through the family networks of the pre-existing Slovak immigrant workforce. But the commodity logic of equivalence, that is, of overlooking particular differences in race, gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation, musical taste, and so on, is permanently present in capitalist labor markets as a kind of a pressure. This pressure is surely at least a contributing factor in the diminishing discrimination on the basis of race and gender in contemporary American labor markets over the last three decades. However, I think it would be a major mistake to attribute changes in patterns of equality or inequality, either one, purely to the self-interested calculation of either capitalists or workers. It's obvious, for example, that declining discrimination against African Americans, women, and gays in the US in recent decades has been strongly affected by movements of social and political contestation, movements based on egalitarian ideologies of recognizably Enlightenment provenance, movements that have had strong effects on laws, citizen attitudes, and everyday talk and conduct. This observation leads me to the final portion of my talk, which leaps back in time to explore the connections between capitalism and the emergence of these very Enlightenment concepts in 18th century France. Although it's clear that many intellectual and political movements directed against capitalism have themselves been derived from Enlightenment ideas, and Marxism is probably the best known and the most important of these, I believe that key aspects of Enlightenment thought were themselves made possible by the early phases of capitalist development in the 18th century, or at least in part made possible thereby. Of course, there's a long Marxist tradition of interpreting Enlightenment ideologies as a reflection of the material interests of the rising bourgeoisie. I think there is a grain of truth in such arguments, but my claims today will be very different. I'll argue instead that Enlightenment notions about the basic equality of all men, and sometimes going beyond that to the basic equality of all humans, were made thinkable in part by emerging forms of social relations generated by early capitalism. I'll be looking at the French case, both because France was, after all, at the epicenter of the Enlightenment, and also because I know a lot more about French history than about, say, English history or Dutch history or early American history, to name the other likely suspects when we're talking about early capitalism. The first thing to recognize about the French Enlightenment is that its ideas about equality were elaborated in an extraordinarily unequal hierarchical society. French society was, before the French Revolution, conventionally divided into three ranked estates or orders: the clergy, the nobility, and the commoners, who were also called the third estate. The clergy was the first estate because its function was to deal with lofty spiritual rather than base material concerns. The clergy itself was internally hierarchically ordered, with the Pope at the top, followed by cardinals, archbishops, bishops, down to ordinary parish priests, monks, and nuns. The nobility was the second estate. Its traditional function was to protect the kingdom by force of arms and to provide counsel to the king. Again, there was considerable hierarchy within the nobility, with princes of the blood at the top, followed by dukes, marquises, counts, barons, ordinary knights. Nobility was passed down in the blood. You were a noble because your father was a noble. Although it's also true that the king had the power to raise commoners to noble status, effectively purging the blood of the newly ennobled of all taint of commonness. It's also true that the older nobles, those who were blood nobles, were rather suspicious of these ennobled characters. Finally, the third estate was made up of those who possessed neither the dignity of nobility nor the dignity of the clergy. That is, they were those who lacked dignity. Although the third estate accounted for over 90% of the population, conceptually, it was a residual category. That is, it was those who had no dignity. There was, however, plenty of hierarchy within the third estate as well. Merchants, doctors, lawyers, and practitioners of the liberal arts were at the top, while those practicing the manual arts of trade, commerce, and agriculture were ranked at a lower level. Within the third estate, the urban occupations generally were organized into guilds of one kind or another, and these were ranked by a variety of criteria, by their wealth, the extent to which they practiced commerce as opposed to manufacturing, whether they were clean or dirty trades, the nobility, the relative nobility of the raw materials they used. So goldsmiths were ranked above blacksmiths, silk weavers above woolen weavers, and so on. And within each of the guilds, there were further ranks. There were masters, journeymen, and apprentices. So everyone stood in this very complex hierarchy of ranks. The key relation in, or the key question in 18th century social relations was where one ranked by comparison with one's fellows. But the question of ranks was always open, in fact, to dispute and maneuver of one kind or of another, to disputes about precedence and also to many strategies for improving one's position. One acted differently toward those who were above one and might be able to benefit one, and those who were regarded as below one. Using contacts with those of higher rank to obtain goals was often imperative. It was how you managed to get by or to get ahead in the old regime. The predominant everyday experience of the society that developed the most pointed and extensive arguments for human equality, that of 18th century France, was, in other words, utterly steeped in hierarchy. Enlightenment discourse about equality was very definitively a counter-discourse, one that ran against the grain of and contained a critique of everyday social experience. The Enlightenment discourse of equality was, in other words, more an alternative social imaginary than it was any kind of description of or apology for the status quo. Yet one might reasonably ask, doesn't even an alternative social imaginary require some kind of basis in lived experience? I think that it does. I don't think you can simply be in a hierarchical society and then imagine its opposite without having something on which to base that imagination, some kind of social experience on which to base that imagination. My hunch is that at least one of the sources the emerging social relations of capitalism provided at least one of these experiential bases for the emergence of an egalitarian ideology. One might imagine that the key development would have been the increasing commoditization of labor, which would tend to minimize the significance of people's multifarious claims for social prestige and for distinction, and to maximize a sense of equivalence that's based on competency and on earnings. The fact that what was called la carrière ouverte au talent, in other words, the career open to talents, the fact that this was a major, a prominent demand in the French Revolution of 1789 seems to me an indication that something of this sort had surely been going on in the previous decades. That is, that increasing commoditization of labor is one of the sources. But I don't think that increased commoditization of labor can be the sole explanation for the thinkability of equality in the 18th century. My reading of materials from this era indicates that while commoditization of labor was certainly advancing, both in the city and in the countryside, its pace and effects were not sufficient to displace the very strong work identities that were supplied by the guild and by the guilds and the ideology of the guilds. Even workers who were being subjected to various new forms of capitalist exploitation tended to think about their problems and to frame their collective actions in the guild's language and moral categories. Now, I should warn you that I'm still in very early stages of a new research project on these very questions. So at this point, what I'm giving you are strong hunches, not firm conclusions. But I strongly suspect that experiences in the realm of consumption were actually more important as a condition of possibility for Enlightenment conceptions of equality than experiences in the realm of production. Let's consider the case of clothing, which was the most important single consumption expenditure in the 18th century after food and shelter. If we go back to the 16th or the 17th century, we find that clothing correlated very neatly with social status. Walking down a street in Paris, you could distinguish clerics, nobles, bourgeois, lawyers, servants, or craftsmen of the various trades by the clothing they wore. What they wore were the traditional costumes of their social rank or trade. By the late 18th century, this was no longer the case, or at least it wasn't reliably the case anymore. Clerics, to be sure, still wore clerical garb, but nobles wore the same kinds of dresses or suits as bourgeois. Especially on their day off, when they were participating in the by now customary Sunday stroll in public gardens or the major thoroughfares, places like the Jardin des Tuileries or the Palais Royal, it could be difficult to tell whether the stylishly dressed gentleman or lady one met was indeed of the distinguished social status that his or her costume implied. One's polite and well-dressed interlocutor might turn out to be a saddler or a lady's maid got up in their Sunday best. This unreadability of the social world was actually a common theme of the many writers, not all of them aristocrats, who in these years denounced what they called luxury as a moral evil. Increasingly, by the mid to late 18th century, a sphere of social relations developed that was characterized by a kind of social anonymity and a certain sartorial uniformity. This was true not only at the Sunday promenade, but also daily in the cafes that proliferated in Paris in the 18th century. The café, which remains today, as those of you who've been to France know, the key institution of the peculiar Parisian form of public sociability, dates precisely from this era. The first café was opened in Paris in the late 17th century. By 1788, there were no fewer than 1,800 cafés in Paris. That's a lot of cafés. So this is a period of just the proliferation of these peculiar kinds of public spaces that are a complete novelty in the urban scene. I believe it was largely this palpable experience of a certain, what you might call, interstitial public social anonymity, what one might call a civic equivalence, that made equality increasingly thinkable in the 18th century. I call this civic equivalence interstitial because it took place at the edges or in the cracks of a still overwhelmingly hierarchical social order. So the dominant experience that one had was certainly one of ranking someplace in a hierarchy, of kicking down and kissing up. But one also had this other experience that happened at least from time to time, where one was dealing in a more or less anonymous way with people whose social rank you couldn't necessarily read. That is, there's an anonymity and a civic equivalence in these public spaces, it seems to me. This emerging sphere of civic equivalence was, of course, made possible by a particular form of consumer capitalism. That is, by innovations in the production and marketing of consumer products. Again, consider clothing. Over the course of the 18th century, the heavy woolens and silk velvets that had dominated luxury consumption in the 17th century were increasingly displaced by lighter and more colorful silks, and by light, colorful, and relatively cheap printed cottons that were increasingly within the means of servants, clerks, petty manufacturers, or shopkeepers. These new fashions began among wealthy aristocrats in the late 17th century, but they very quickly spread outward and downward and became quite general by the middle of the 18th century. As a consequence of the joint efforts of a growing army of silk and cotton textile producers, stylish retailers of fashionable cloth, seamstresses and tailors, and, not the least important, tens of thousands of well-informed and fashion-conscious consumers, fashionable clothing proliferated in Paris and other large cities in the 18th century. Women of all classes who died in 1788 had, on average, something like four times as many dresses as comparable women who died in 1700. And men had about twice as many suits. There was a kind of sexual dimorphism in dress that produced itself during this time. Nor was this generalization of stylish and readily available commodities limited to clothing. I've already mentioned coffee, which was originally a luxury drink, but it had become a necessity for all classes by the end of the century. The historian Cissy Fairchild has documented the rise in 18th century Paris of an entire penumbra of what she calls populux goods, that is, they're popular, consumed by the populace at large, but they're also a certain kind of luxury. She found that a surprisingly high proportion of ordinary people, that is, servants, workers, petty bourgeois, shopkeepers, and the like, possessed gold watches, canes, umbrellas, wigs, stockings, snuff boxes, books, crockery, and fans, all goods that initially were taken up above all by the wealthy and by aristocrats, but that were quickly copied and spread to the masses by alert manufacturers, merchants, and consumers. In spite of the highly unequal distribution of income in 18th century Paris, ordinary people quite literally bought into the standards of civility and politeness that had become the rage among their betters in the Age of Enlightenment. I'm convinced that this new interstitial uniformity of lifestyle and taste across the vast social income divides of 18th century Paris were a crucial context for the development of a social imaginary of equality. I could go on at considerably greater length about 18th century France, but it's time for me to wrap up these remarks. I think I've said enough to indicate that the social forms characteristic of capitalism, both on the production and on the consumption side, are capable of generating pressures for a certain form of equality, particularly those forms of equality that we call equality of opportunity, equality before the law, and equal citizenship. This is equality as equivalence, right? Citizens are equal not in the sense that they're all the same size, the same weight, have the same income. They're equivalent in the sense that they all have the same rights, right? The same political rights, the same rights before in a court of law. And I think this logic of equivalence is something that that at least we can say at least has a suspicious similarity to the logic of the commodity form. Nor was this elective affinity with equality possible only at capitalism's rosy dawn in the 18th century, when free enterprise seemed to offer liberation from a hierarchical aristocratic society in which extremes of wealth seemed to be entirely the consequence of rank and patronage. The logic of equivalence, rather, I believe, is built into the fundamental social relations of capitalism, and it continues to exert a pressure toward equality, to make equality thinkable and desirable in the present. At the same time that it's part and parcel of capitalism's tendency toward ever-advancing concentration of capital and inequality of incomes. We have been living for over 300 years in contradictory times. Thank you. Questions? Objections? Yeah.
Yeah, I want to push you a bit on the on consumption being the kind of the focus between which for equality emerged.
And
a conventional counter argument would be the effect of consumption is actually an extraordinary relative perception of difference. That is, to be sure, members of the lower classes will come over time to adopt the practices, the consumption practices at the top. But as soon as that happens, new differences are developed and featured so as to establish the principle of inequality and make it those at the top have consumption practices different from those at the bottom. So consumption then becomes a tool for establishing difference, not as you seem to suggest, a tool for generating inequality.
Right. Yes, I think it operates in both ways. It certainly is the case that that aristocrats in the 18th century did everything they could to distinguish themselves not only from bourgeois and ordinary people, but also from aristocrats of a lesser rank. But it's an interesting thing that that the actual styles of clothing and the kinds of cloth and the patterns on the cloth that they preferred were not so different from those that were consumed by the lower orders. Not the lowest orders, mostly could only consume, fustians, nasty cloth. But from the sort of the middle on up, there was a certain kind of uniformity. The interesting thing that happens, and this doesn't really happen until the very end of the 17th century, probably a little earlier in Britain and possibly a little earlier in the Netherlands, is that you actually get the development of a fashion system and of a fashion cycle that I think had just not been the case before. You do not see, say, in the 16th century, ordinary people adopting the dress of the wealthy. They'd be in trouble if they tried to do that. There are sumptuary laws of various kinds. They would be likely to be beaten on the streets by their betters if they tried to adopt that dress. But by the 18th century, this is no longer the practice, right? So it's true that there is this, that the rich try to adopt a new style, but in a commercial system of the sort that had developed in Paris, particularly in the 18th century, no sooner is a new style adopted by the very wealthiest of the aristocrats than the merchants are trying to peddle it to everybody. Right, so it's true that it's a means of distinction, but I think the means of distinction operates very differently under capitalism than under pre-capitalist forms. That is, there was a kind of stability of what one wore according to rank before, and that just gets broken down under capitalism. So I think I don't want to say that inequality goes away, or that you couldn't possibly tell the difference between a wealthy aristocrat and some petty bourgeois who had managed to buy a decent suit. Sure, usually you could, and the wealthy did their best to distinguish themselves by having very fancy clothing. If you saw somebody with a lot of gold threads in the silk, you knew they were definitely wealthy. Right, so there were ways of making these distinctions, but they're very different from the ways that were present previously. Yeah?
Can I just push David's point a little mm-hmm. bit further? If you were Pierre Bourdieu and you're trying to make this argument, I think what you would say would be that when there are these conditions, that the groups that are in some way cohesive or coherent really make a strenuous effort to develop distinctions that are sometimes subtle, mm-hmm. but that they certainly recognize.
Yes.
Maybe that from down below you can't recognize it.
Yeah.
But the people who are in that group
sure.
develop differences that have nothing to do with threads, but with all sorts of
right.
subtle cultural
right.
capital of various kinds,
yeah.
and which may include sartorial capital.
Right.
That make distinctions that people really aren't able to distinguish unless they're pretty close to that group.
Yeah.
And that can be a very effective way. It's a new kind of system, to be sure,
right.
because there were huge differences in the 15th, 16th century when you had the sumptuary.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can tell at a glance. Mm-hmm. Now in the 18th century, you needed to do more than glance, but if you were in that category of people that were really attuned to that, there would be no question in your mind, because these cheap knockoffs
yeah.
would be immediately visible to you as cheap knockoffs, even though they might not be obvious to people who are far
right.
from the class. So if
yeah.
that's true,
mm-hmm.
and it does raise the question of how that could in itself be a pressure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you can see how from below it would create certain kinds of pressures. It's not so much pressure for equality as it is the thinkability of it, right? The fact that you are sometimes in this anonymous situation where you're not quite sure who everyone is. It certainly is true that, I assume it's true that the wealthy developed these very subtle signs. And I don't know, it could be that these are entirely apocryphal, but you keep running into in texts, many of them written by aristocrats, this kind of stock story over and over again, that you're out for a stroll in the Tuileries and you see this rather nice-looking, polite fellow, and you engage in conversation, and then you find out that he's your good friend's saddler or your good friend's manservant, and you're mortified. To find that that's the case. And this is then used as kind of an argument against luxury. So this may be an apocryphal story, but it's told from above, as if there is somehow some difficulty on their part in recognizing differences. Now, it's possible that it's really not that difficult for them to recognize the differences, but what they are recognizing is a certain presumption, presumptuousness from below, people attempting to pass themselves off as their equals. In any case, I don't want to deny that there are all kinds of distinctions that are made with respect to dress and manners and so on, as there are today. But what I do want to claim is that there's something very different going on in 18th century sociability from what was going on in previous forms of urban sociability that made the world somehow seem different. And I still need to do a lot more research to tie it all down. Yeah?
It seems that there are different kinds of differences.
Mm-hmm.
difference which is being pointed to is a different kind of difference than if you just have more bold in your in your code or not.
Yes.
So it's a shift from a
qualitative to a quantitative.
Incommensurability.
Yes.
To a system of commensurability.
Right.
So it really, from that, if
yes.
that were true, then it would really be a very profound difference.
Yeah.
That's just a comment. My question is this: how do you relate your story to the other post 1848 story about France, that is to say, the Tocqueville one?
Mm-hmm.
The point of which would be to say that yes, the development of capitalism in France is no less important than it is in England. But what differentiates the two and produces the strong ideology of equality has to do with the state system and the tax system and the way in which conflicts over taxation produces much more extreme polarities between inequality and equality.
Yeah, well, the other thing that Tocqueville claims is that equality is produced by turning everyone into an administré, right? Everybody is administered by the central state, and that puts them in a certain relation of equality as well. So I don't want to argue that this is the only possible, you know, form of experience of something like equality that's going on. I think it's one that there's been quite a lot of research in recent years to show that there are big changes going on in the consumption sphere. What I don't think has been thought through is how this relates to some of these, you know, larger historical transformations, like the rise of egalitarianism, and it seems to me that that's something that that makes sense as a possible interpretation. So I'm trying to argue here.
As I heard you telling. Going to the historical story, I more and more just maybe a particularly American context, but I think it's French too, begin to wonder about the two concepts, and I wonder how they fit into your narrative. One is republicanism, and not of the Reagan variety, but earlier
right.
variety,
classical
and property,
yeah.
and how property is then also associated with freedom.
Well, certainly there was a vogue for republicanism, both in France and in Britain and in all of the Atlantic world in the course of the 18th century. I can't say I've quite figured out how these things fit together at this point. It's a good question that I guess I can't actually try to give an answer to at this point.
That becomes, that's an important distinction, in equality and inequality.
Yeah, well, property is a really complicated affair. There are so many different kinds of property under the old regime by comparison with, say, the system after the French Revolution. For instance, one had a property in one's various privileges. And that was considered to be a property that was equivalent to one's property in land or houses or personal effects. So there certainly was the development of a language of property, but it was used both to argue in favor of the legitimacy of privilege, as well as against the legitimacy of privilege.
So, if capitalism does have this paradoxical nature, and that kind of creates more income inequality, but maybe a more social or a false sense of income equality, then how do you evaluate this in the sense of the poverty question in general, or for its positive or negative impact on society in general?
Well, I'm not sure I can talk about the poverty question in general. I mean, capitalism is not the only source of poverty. right? I mean, I think one of the things that made the 18th century situation rather different from our situation is that most of the inequality predated capitalism, right? And so the development of this new kind of commodity exchange, both in consumption and in production, actually seemed to be a way of kind of getting outside of the existing forms of inequality. In fact, one of the interesting things that was very commonly argued in the late 18th century was that adopting a system of laissez-faire, doing away with regulations, doing away with privileges of all kinds, in other words, moving toward a more kind of capitalistically defined society, that would actually increase equality. That was the general sense in the 18th century. For poverty in the present, I mean, you know, there one way you can think about it in the present is that with respect, say, to consumption, is that all of these things seem to be kind of dual-edged. On the one hand, our styles of consumption, just as in the 18th century, our styles of consumption became more and more uniform. That's still the case, right? Here I am, a recently retired professor, making an argument wearing blue jeans, right? This is something that my father would certainly never have done. And my grandfather, although he was not a professor, certainly would be unthinkable that you would wear workman's clothes, right, in a public situation like this. So there's been a kind of a leveling of the sort of outward signs of wealth. It seems to me, in many respects, say with respect to clothing. There's also been the adoption of consumption styles that come from below. Right, so hip-hop styles of clothing are worn by suburban white youth. Consumption in that respect, I think, again, can kind of cut either way. Yeah?
Related to the question of poverty, I think the neoliberal would argue that although the virtue of capitalism is that it creates a system that's not as a zero-sum game, and therefore you can have inequality increasing, but yet the poor getting richer at the same time. Now, historically, do you think that inequality has been correlated with a lack of social mobility?
With a lack of social mobility?
Yeah, or with a non-zero-sum game?
You can have equality in either case. I mean, you can have extreme inequality and relatively high rates of social mobility. I mean, we at least thought in the at the turn of from the 19th to the 20th century, the general notion was that social mobility was relatively easy in the United States. Yet at that time, social inequality was gigantic, right? So I think they're actually quite independent questions. The degree of inequality and the degree of social mobility. I suppose that if you get far enough to extremes, it becomes difficult to make it from the bottom to the top if you have no resources. So at the extreme, certainly huge degrees of inequality would make social mobility difficult. So at the extreme, I think there's a kind of correlation, but I think there's a huge range of possibilities in between. You can have societies with just fairly moderate levels of inequality that don't particularly have high rates of social mobility. Yeah.
Capitalism historically is good.
quite understand why, what effect that would have one way or the other on the dynamism of capitalism. Could you?
I mean, you cannot, to my mind, you cannot view capitalism as simply generating inequality.
Yeah.
Because it also produces education. Education, because it's becoming generalized, diminishes inequality as well. It has a direct impact. If everybody gets the same education, then everybody will get the same wage. It has an indirect impact,
right,
because it will, for instance, introduce redistribution and so on and so on.
Yeah, but you know, if you look at contemporary societies, we have pretty much generalized literacy and education in the United States. Obviously, there's a difference between those who graduate from high school and those who have advanced degrees, but we pretty much have a general education, right? Not all that different from, say, Sweden, right, which also has universal education. Yet there are huge differences between Sweden and the United States with respect to social inequality. So I don't see why you would assume that education is necessarily going to lead to equality. If the education is sufficiently equal, right? If everyone is educated to the level of a PhD, then presumably there will be less inequality than if some people have a grade school education and other people have PhDs. But it seems to me that, you know, what's happened is not so much that education has become more and more uniform over time, but rather